The title of my presentation today is called Positive Parenting. I hope that you'll interrupt anytime you have something that you'd like to contribute. I appreciate that. Since there are no perfect parents, and it's really not a very good idea to try to be one, the best we can hope to be are wise and positive parents. If we feel good about ourselves and have confidence in our own parenting skills, chances are our children, too, will have positive self-images. The approval of our mate is very important in this, to keep us undergirded and feeling good about ourselves. It's easy to get in the habit of put-downs in the home, and this we want to avoid at all costs because it doesn't do anybody any good. We usually treat our children as extensions of ourselves. So if we feel good about ourselves, we'll feel good about our progeny. We have three children. They're all married, and we have two of our grandchildren here, Todd and Eric Griffin. When their mother was our oldest daughter, and that was 41 years ago. But principles haven't changed too much, I notice, except that they've loosened up considerably. Now it's okay to use your own judgment and read everything you can about child development and learn all you can about children, but then use your own common sense in being good parents. I know with Diane, we went by the book. Believe me, we went by the book. And the doctor gave me strict orders not to nurse her more than every 4 hours. And we stayed with my parents for 2 weeks before we moved on to Oklahoma City. And my mother said, "Oh, that's cruel. That's absolutely cruel. I wish I had listened to her." But I said, "But the doctor and the nurse said, you got to wait, no matter how much they cry." And poor Diane cried and cried. It didn't ruin her, however. She turned out okay. But, gee, when I think of what we did to her as a tiny baby, it makes me cringe. And the next child, I was much more relaxed. I had tried it once, and I had more confidence in myself. I had more self-esteem as a parent, let's say. And so I read the books. I belonged to a parenting group in AAUW, and we had a delightful counselor who was about my age now. And she taught us a lot of good common sense parenting because she had been through it. And so I read the books, used my common sense. When Linda came along, my third one, I threw the book away. I think we do need a background of knowledge, but we need to combine that with our own good common sense. Psychiatrists and other authorities have become increasingly convinced that self-esteem is an essential but all too often neglected ingredient in every child's development. Children with high self-esteem have the confidence to make their own way in the world. They are healthy, well-nourished children who tend to make friends easily and are not easily influenced by those with less high ideals. They're usually leaders. They do not feel that it's necessary to follow the crowd when they see that the crowd is headed in the wrong direction. In other words, they have the moral stamina to withstand peer pressure. And oh, how important that is as they grow older, because there is peer pressure, and far more than we realize until we get to that point. When does self-esteem begin to develop? In the beginning, it develops at the hospital and in the cradle. The bonding in the hospital is so important. and this takes place shortly after birth between the mother and the baby, and is really the beginning of positive self-esteem. At this time, the child feels the love and affirmation of his mother and even his father when the father is privileged to hand the child to the mother immediately after birth. When parents tend to the initial wants of their baby with food and dry diapers in answer to the baby's cries, the baby learns that he or she is important and nourished and nurtured. The parents who keep up a chatter with their baby while they bathe, dress, and play with him or her continues to send positive messages to the child. Words of love and affection take the place of uncomplimentary names like stinker and bad baby, and I know you've heard those over and over. Do you remember any of the terrible nicknames you or your friends were given that really stuck, like fatty and skinny and runt and
bean?
Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Beanpole. Any other?
I was Donald Duck.
Donald Duck, okay. Did you like it very much?
No.
No, you don't like it? These names do very little to build self-esteem, and when heard over and over, tear it down little by little. If you ever say anything to a child, or to anyone else for that matter, to make them think less of themselves, we are destroying something very precious within them. We need to look for strengths and not weaknesses. And that's, I remember particularly of getting a phone call from the Catholic Social Agency. I was a director of the lab school at Augustana College for 6.5 years. And the social worker said, do you take children who are emotionally disturbed? And I said, we try them and we'll do the best we can. I've never turned one down yet. And we've always been able to manage, but I'm not making any promises. Well, she says, this little boy is the youngest of 4 children, and their parents left them, just left them completely. And the psychiatrist who is taking care of him and once a week now suggests that a nursery school might be very helpful. And I said, well, I have a long waiting list, but I had just gotten a phone call telling me that one of my children was moving. So I said, I'll give him that spot. I'm sure none of the mothers would object who happened to be waiting if they knew the circumstances. Well, I wondered to myself, what am I going to say to Mike when he comes? Well, when he walked in, he was the most beautiful child with these great big brown eyes. And I said, oh, what beautiful brown eyes. I didn't realize what an impact that made on that poor child who probably had been getting very little affirmation. He was very nervous, and I'd let him play in warm, sudsy water to calm him down. And when he was going with the rest of the children to second floor where they took their naps and listened to tapes, the student teachers usually took charge of that part of the program. I told the student teacher who was going to watch over Mike, I said, let him put his head on your lap and you keep stroking him and try to keep him just as calm as you can. But if he gets too wiggly and he can't take it anymore, let him come down with me and I'll let him play in warm, sudsy water and I'll talk to him. Well, it wasn't long until I heard the little footsteps down the stairs, and when I opened the door, before I had a chance to say anything, he said, but Mrs. Edmund, I do have beautiful eyes, haven't I? So one thing he grabbed onto, and it wasn't long until I always kept him right by me and held his hand or put my arm around him or stroked him or did something while I was talking to the rest of the children. And Rudy came later on in the spring to talk to them about their rocks, and he couldn't tell which one Mike was. So he had learned to really calm down and fit into the group. I explained to the group before he came that he really needed their love, and I knew that they would give it to him. And they certainly did. You ask children 4 years old if they'll do something for you, and you don't have any problems. Quite a number of years ago, Dr. Stanley Cooper Smith, chairman of the Department of Psychology of the University of California, Davis, did a revealing study which showed that parental acceptance combined with strictness is conspicuous in homes of parents who are getting good results. It is, however, a special kind of strictness, not to be confused with excessive reliance on punishment, which assures the child that his parents love him and are concerned for his welfare. Dr. Cooper Smith's study is focused squarely on the factor in human personality which we have been referring to as self-esteem, the attitude which each child has toward himself and which affects his attitude toward the outside world. He can't think much of himself, he can't think much of other people until he thinks well of himself first. In the families that were interviewed, almost all of them reported that the firm rules set in their families were enforced carefully and consistently. They found rewards more effective than punishments. When children know the boundaries, punishment is seldom needed. This was certainly true with my experience with four-year-olds at the lab school at Augustana. We always explained the rules very carefully and had a positive attitude of expectancy. We didn't talk about what would happen to them if they didn't do it. We just assumed they would do it, and they did. No one was expected to go beyond the reasonable boundaries. They understood that rules are designed to protect them and promote an environment conducive to learning and happy living. This was also a way for each child to feel that he really belonged. We always worked for a sort of a classroom spirit where they were proud of their school. And you can do that in Sunday school too, Sunday church school. Make them work up this class spirit so that they are really concerned about each other and call each other if they're not there on Sunday morning. That's a lot better than having a teacher call. Is it possible for a child to develop too much self-esteem? Dr. Cooper Smith found no evidence of this, but he makes the distinction between self-confidence and vanity, arrogance, boastfulness, and excessive pride. These traits are often symptoms of low self-esteem, hidden deeper inside. It is the child or adult who is unsure of his worth who must seize every occasion to boast and behave arrogantly. Sometimes the false front, such as an adult or child erects, is designed to bolster his self-image, as well as to impress other people. Your impulse is to put a person down who keeps bragging about himself. But the way to get him over it is to keep affirming him, telling him the nice things that you can about him. And then he won't find it necessary to do it himself. Do we really want our children to develop high self-esteem? All parents, of course, want their children to be self-confident after they grow up and leave home. But some parents prefer to keep their children meek and submissive in the meantime. They reveal an almost compulsive need to belittle their children in various ways. They tell visitors, for example, while their children are present, about the children's shortcomings. How often have you heard friends or neighbors thoughtlessly make remarks such as these to their children? Let me do that. You're such butterfingers, you'll be sure to break it. No, put the fork on the left side. A big girl like you can't be so stupid you don't know the right from the left. Yes, we took Jerry to the lake yesterday, but he wouldn't even try to learn to swim. He's such a, nothing but a scaredy cat. You know, we as teachers, as well as parents, are apt to put the wrong construction on some of the children's actions that are really could be positive. For instance, a sense of humor. It's so easy for a teacher to label that child as a smart aleck. If we do that, then he'll be a smart aleck. But if we don't, that natural humor will just bubble over in the most beautiful way. We had that experience with one of our children who, in nursery school, who was always seeing the humorous side of things. Remember, he was sitting at a table with a little black boy, and it was a long time ago, before black was beautiful, and we hadn't done the educating we have up to this point. And when I came by, I said, "Well, how are you boys doing?" And the little black boy said, "Not so good. Mark says I'm black, and my mother says I'm brown." And Mark says, "Oh, don't pay any attention to me. I don't know my colors too good. I always did get black and brown mixed up." And time and again, he would come through with these things, making people feel good after things got a little bit tense. So I appreciated him in my class. And when he didn't, and that next fall, I really missed him. And I saw his mother at a football game, and I said, "You know, we really miss Mark. He was such a joy with his sense of humor. How's he doing in kindergarten?" She said, "I'm afraid he isn't doing too well. His teacher thinks he's a smart aleck." That just made me sick, because really, if she had enjoyed him like we did, he could have developed into a really terrific, well, he probably did anyway. I doubt that he was completely squelched, but at least she wasn't affirming that part of his personality that I thought was a very positive attribute. I'm sure you've heard these 13 ways given to mold a child, but I'm going to read them anyway because I think they fit here so well. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with fear, he learns to be apprehensive. If a child lives with pity, he learns to feel sorry for himself. If a child lives with jealousy, he learns to hate. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns to be confident. If a child lives with praise, he learns to be appreciative. If a child lives with acceptance, he learns to love. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with recognition, he learns to have a goal. If a child lives with friendliness, he learns justice. If a child lives with honesty, he learns what truth is. If a child lives with friendliness, he learns that the world is a nice place to live. Now, the author of that is unknown, but I think it really puts in a nutshell something for parents to remember. I know when our children were younger, we had this on a flannel wall hanging, which I think was a good reminder. There was a man by the name of Charles Schaeffer who did a little investigating of parents who had really done a good job with their children. Their children were grown now and were contributing to society. And he asked them one question and kept track of what the answers were. And it was amazing how much they agreed on specific things about how they raised their children. He talked to 50 parents, and this is what he asked them. Based upon your personal experiences with your own children, what is the best advice you could give new parents about raising children? Schaefer asked this question of these 50 parents who had successfully raised their own children. And their children, all over age 21, were considered successful in the sense that they were all productive adults who were apparently adjusting well to our society. A total of 35 mothers and 15 fathers, ranging in the age from 44 to 75, from primarily white middle-class backgrounds. And that's what we are here. So I think it applies. Wrote their responses to this question. He conducted this survey with parents with whom he was acquainted through business, social, and civic contacts, because most of the popular books on child rearing are written by theorists who tend to offer idealistic and sometimes conflicting opinions. Experienced parents, on the other hand, are the practitioners who are most likely to know what really works in the home environment. The results of the survey reveal that these parents not only have very definite ideas about child rearing, but their ideas were very similar. So it seems to be a common parent sense about effective parenting. One of the first of the 10 guidelines that they gave that he summarized, first of all, was love abundantly. According to these parents, the first and most important task is to love and really care about children. This not only gives the child a sense of security, belonging, and support, but it also smooths out the rough edges of childhood. Parental love should be special in two respects. It should be constant and unconditional, which means it's always present, even when the child is acting in a most unlovable manner. Secondly, parents should be open in expressing and showing love so that children are never uncertain about its presence. This means parents should love, hug, and praise their children every time it occurs to them and not worry about spoiling the children. Don't forget to tell the children you love them and keep them aware of this love. There's one father who was here a couple of weeks ago who was telling about his experience with his little 10-year-old daughter. He said, we were going through a time where she didn't do anything right. He said, I was on her constantly. Finally, my wife really became concerned, and she took a parenting course and came home with one suggestion that really worked. She said, you're not supposed to correct her on anything now for a certain length of time. Just don't say anything negative, but every time she does something right, you talk about it and tell her that that was great. He said it only took 2 weeks to turn that relationship completely around. And now she comes to him and when he corrects her, he does it in a loving way, not a put-down way. He said this had changed his relationship with his daughter completely at a very important age, because it's hard enough to get along with your children when they go through the teenagers, when they're trying to get their independence, and a lot of times it's really tough even with the kids who have always complied in a reasonable way to your suggestions and to your parenting. But to have this sort of a relationship that was so negative at the age of 10 would have been devastating had it continued for 2 or 3 more years. These parents that Schaefer talked to made these comments in regard to the importance of loving. Children should be caressed both physically and verbally, and they should know that they are loved because of the special qualities that make them individuals. these individuals that they are becoming. And I think it's very important here for dads to hug their sons. And some dads have been brought up saying, that's not manly. You can't make a man out of a kid if you're going to hug him and kiss him. I mean, he'll just become a sissy. Well, we had another father here who was telling me that his two-year-old never wanted to go to him. He always wanted to go to his mother to be dressed or to have anything done for him. And he said it was really concerning him. And his mother was here in the village too. And she came up to me and she said, you know, that's our fault. She said, we brought him up with the idea that we shouldn't be soft with him, that we shouldn't hug him and kiss him. That was for girls. We wanted to make a man out of him. And now, she said, he is having this struggle himself. So we did some talking about how it was okay to be affectionate with your child, and chances are if he started being affectionate, the child would want to come to him and also make a game. You know, two-year-olds, they're so negative. They're just like teenagers. They're finding their independence, the first independence they're finding, and that is to sever themselves from their parents so that they can be real people. And sometimes it's hard to take. Mm-hmm. And many parents, especially fathers, if it's a son that keeps saying, no, I'm going to see to it that he minds me or else, you know, and they'll beat it into him. And in my child abuse session, I talk about this, the fact that one age that is most abused is two-year-olds. Simply because they are in the stage of development that where they must seek their independence. If we would become better informed as to what is natural, the natural development, and what we can expect from children at certain ages, what is their developmental task? Not asking them to go beyond what they're ready for. And this goes for moral development too. If you're familiar with Kohlberg, he sets out the different steps, the stages that children must go through in order to understand what is right and what is wrong. Discipline means setting and adhering to standards of behavior. Discipline is teaching. That is the first definition we get, for instance, from the Bible. Jesus had disciples. He taught the disciples. The disciples taught what they had learned from Jesus. So if we think of discipline not as punishment, but as teaching, I think that we won't be so worried about having good discipline in the respect of punishing. After love, the parents stress the importance of giving clear directions and enforcing limits on a child's behavior. When administered out of love, discipline is an essential preparation for adjusting to the outside world. As I mentioned earlier, I belonged to this parenting group when my children were little, and the lady who did our advising said that she and her husband had quite an argument when their children were little, because he said he did not want to do any of the punishing because he wanted his children to love him. And she said, well, I think it's important, more important, that other people are going to love our children. And this is so true. I mean, if they learn what is accepted behavior, they will feel the approval from those people around them. If they go to visit someone or if they go to a public place, they will be getting positive vibes, you might say, that has a very good effect on their personality. If we let them get by with things that they really shouldn't get by with, we're not doing them a favor at all. Because they must have this understanding in order that later on they will be better prepared to adjust to school when they go to public school and to the outside world in general. It not only makes a child better behaved, but happier. They're happier with themselves. They don't like themselves very well when they're always naughty. It is best to say do this rather than always saying don't. It's a much more positive approach, especially with the very young child. If we can distract him from his negative behavior and give him something positive to take its place, then it is so much easier on us, and it's always also on him. I know one little boy, you can usually tell when something negative is coming up in behavior. You get body signals, you get all kinds of signals from your child if you learn to observe him carefully. And that's so important, because I think that tantrums are not necessary if the parent is guarding against it. I know one little boy came in, and he started just tearing up the place. He tore up before we'd gotten realized what his tendencies were. He had torn up somebody's butterfly that they had brought carefully saved on cotton. He had broken my Oriental figurines, little Japanese figures. And I thought, what's with this boy? I've got to stop him before he does these things. And after watching him, I realized that when he was ready to do something destructive, his little arms would go back and forth like this, and fists would go, and then you knew he was ready to go out and really do something that would make everybody pay attention to him. So I clued the student teachers in. I said, whenever you see him go along like that with his little fists going back and forth, you be sure, go up, take a hold of his hand, and get him interested in a toy or something, another activity, or maybe what the group is doing, or maybe over in the housekeeping corner, or if nothing else, let him play with some bubbles in warmer water, like we did with Mike when he got antsy and couldn't be quiet. And that worked. And we by just observing him, we stopped a lot of naughty behavior before it ever started. They also suggested that you punish when you say you will. Don't do any idle threading. If there's something that you want them to do, see it through. Don't just let it go and say, I want you to do this, and then ignore it. And if they don't do it, you may have forgotten about it, so you don't. They never get a reprimand. But if you give them something to do, make sure they do it. Take the time to see that they do it. And then give them affirmation for doing it. Be firm by saying what you mean and meaning what you say, and punish as soon after the misdeed as possible, and don't make Daddy the heavy by saying just wait until your father comes home. Be consistent. Don't undermine the rules set by your spouse. Disagreements regarding child rearing must be resolved in privacy, never in front of the children. Be clear. Establish a few simple rules and spell them out clearly in advance. There should be no confusion on the part of the child. Well, I didn't know you meant that. Well, I didn't know. Haven't you heard that over and over? And they're probably right. Administer in private. If possible, never punish a child in front of anyone. This tends to antagonize the child, and he or she may continue to misbehave to save face. So when we do that, we're just destroying our image in the sight of our child. He thinks less of us, which doesn't do us any good at all. Be reasonable and understanding. Explain the reason why a child is being given directions. The stove is hot. Please keep away so you don't be burned. However, don't be afraid on occasion to say, "Do it because I say so." In addition, try to understand a child's point of view and meet him or her halfway. This will give you a closer relationship. Be flexible. With adolescents, bargaining is an effective tool. On occasion, it's good for both parents and child to be able to bend the rules a little. Also, what works with one child will not necessarily work for another. And I'm sure you've found that true if you have more than one. The child's personality enters in. Try to give a child, try to diminish dependency. Give a child an ever-expanding role in making decisions affecting his or her life. This is extremely important, especially when the child has been endowed with an excessive leadership drive. I know one mother came to me and she said, she brought little Mary Jane and she says, "It's either you or a psychiatrist." She says, "Her brother's 8 and he's under the care of a psychiatrist, and I don't want this to happen to Mary Jane." And I said, "Why do you say that?" "Well," she said, she has tantrums all the time. Every day we have tantrums." And I said, "What sets off the tantrums?" Here again, we need to watch and see what comes just before these negative behaviors. And she said, "Well, I can give her a green spoon instead of a pink spoon for her soup at noon." I said, "Why isn't Mary Jane setting the table?" It hadn't occurred to her. She had been waiting on her children hand and foot, not allowing the children to do anything for themselves. And after I had had Mary Jane in my room for a short time, I realized that here's a kid that really has potential. She had all kinds of ambition. She was my chief table wiper offer. She helped all the other kids. And she really, in her own way, she was a delightful kid if you gave her the opportunity to do these things. And so the mother, I clued the mother in. I said, "Just give her jobs. Expect her to do things. Expect her to make her bed. Maybe not perfectly, of course not, but at least work at it. Let her carry out the garbage. Let her set the table. She can dust. All kinds of things she can do for you." So her mother was very grateful for a few practical suggestions and kept calling me about once a week to tell me how Mary Jane was doing at home. And the first time she called, she said, "She has stopped biting her fingernails." And another time she called, "We had only one tantrum this week." And at the end of the year, when Mary Jane was taken to the kindergarten roundup, she called me and she said, "Oh, I wish you could have seen Mary Jane today. She asked me for her insurance money. She said, 'After all, Mother, you aren't the one who's getting registered today, so let me take care of it myself.' Well," she said, "Mary Jane was the only kid in line who didn't have a mother." But she took care of it. And her mother had really caught on to what makes Mary Jane tick. And she certainly didn't need a psychiatrist. So that's one case of where a child, we have to clue into what really makes them tick. And diminishing their dependency on us is certainly doing us a favor as well as the child. Because there is one thing that I really have a little patience with, and that's a martyr mother. Work so hard for you, you know, and then you act like that. Well, why, you know, that's, you may have martyr mothers. I talk to a lot of adults who say they have martyr mothers who want them to feel sorry for them all the time because they have to work so hard. Make the kids do it. At least allow them to do it. Be authoritative, not authoritarian, but authoritative. An authoritarian person does not listen to reason. She just makes the laws and that's it. But authoritative. If you hesitate and are indecisive or feeling guilty about disciplining your children, you're very likely to be ineffective. Remember that you have years of experience, so stick to your decisions. Never let a child talk you out of punishment you believe necessary. Have the courage to call on and trust your own common sense. And if you're not sure, don't give them an answer until you are sure of what the answer should be. Then stick with it. Because it's nothing is more confusing than to have a wishy-washy parent. Well, maybe we can talk them into it, you know. Let's try. So they do. I think it was Dreikers who said, how many of you have read Dreikers? I can't take him wholeheartedly as I can't take very many psychologists wholeheartedly. But there was one thing that he said that I thought that has always stuck with me, and that is, if they stand there and argue and are trying to get you into a power play and you don't know how to stay out of it, go to the bathroom and lock the door. The parents also discussed effective ways of punishing. Now, he said something I did not agree with here in this article, and that is that you should make your child apologize if he has done something to another kid. Well, to me, that you're asking that child more to tell someone else that you're sorry, whether you're sorry or not. And that, to me, is just teaching the child to lie. Mm-hmm. I don't think that a parent should insist on a child telling them they're sorry. They can think of some other form of making it right with that person. And I think that's up to you to talk about, well, what can we do to make it up to Johnny that you were hitting him so hard? Now, he may say, I'll tell him I'm sorry. And if he says he's sorry, that's fine, if he really feels sorry for it at that point. Moreover, the parents generally agreed that spanking a young child, that is, a quick lick on the backside, was okay when necessary. But they cautioned that a child should never be beaten, hit on the head, or hit as a means of satisfying parental anger. I know there was a psychologist in Oklahoma City in the schools there who talked to parents every once in a while, and they would always ask him about, what do you think about spanking? Oh, he said, yeah. He said, it does the parents a lot of good. But, he said, I doubt that it does the child any good. They cautioned that a child shouldn't be beaten, hit on the head, or hit as a means of satisfying parental anger. This finding is in accord with most surveys which disclose that most parents report that they occasionally spank their children. And a lot of children don't need spankings. In fact, if we're pretty skilled parents, we'll find some other way. But that should be the last resort. They said, be firm. When children are told to do something, see follow it through. As a child reaches the age of reason, discipline becomes more a lesson in guidance if the proper groundwork has been laid. Stress discipline. You will find it so much easier and really fun to bring up children who know what they can and cannot do. Children appreciate it, knowing what the score is. And if you take them someplace and they behave well, just brag and brag and brag about them and tell them how proud you are that they behaved so well. Consistency is all important in discipline. Rules that are not meant to be enforced should never be made. A sense of order helps develop a sense of security. Spend time together. Spend time together playing, talking together, and encourage family activities. Do a lot of celebrating. This is one thing that helps the family feel close. We enjoy each other. When somebody flies up in brownies, celebrate. Maybe let them go out to eat their favorite place, or if that's too expensive, let them choose something they want to have for supper that night, and it's their party. And it's amazing how many things we found to celebrate, and it was really ridiculous sometimes. And you know, our daughters are doing the same thing. They celebrate as many ridiculous things as we used to celebrate when they were little. It's just a way of adding fun and togetherness to the spirit of the family. You can walk into a home and tell whether it's a happy home or not. Just step inside the door. There's a spirit in there that envelops you, and you can't miss it. I remember our daughter came home one day, had been visiting with a friend, and she says, "Oh, Mother, I never want to go in there anymore. She says, they can't talk nice to each other. It's just sass, sass, sass all the time." And I think maybe that's the greatest gift we can give our children, is a place where there is some peace and a place where communication can be on a civil basis, where we talk lovingly to each other, and where we can say please and thank you, and it comes naturally. Mm-hmm. Then we don't have to say, "Don't forget to say please." Well, to begin with, we do with the little ones. "What do you say?" You know, is usually what we... But they need to be reminded up to a certain point. Then they do it on their own. They suggested here that you have regular family outings. You are right here at Holden. Special family dinners and spend holidays together. Go to social and sporting and religious events together. Conduct family council meetings and make decisions together. Children should have a chance to enter into the family conversations at mealtime. And there's a lot of kids who are just shut out. I remember I was called in to counsel with a mother whose child was treating her just awfully. She came to our church nursery school, and every time she brought him, he would just do something mean to her. And she came to visit one day, and he wiped paste all over her and poured paint on her. Well, she was beside herself because he obviously hated her. So I said, yes, I would be happy to talk with her. And she told me all these things. And she says, "And you know, the last thing that's happened at our house, he insists on having his high chair turned toward the wall instead of turned toward the table." And I said, "Well, have you been including him in your conversations?" She says, "I'm afraid we haven't." She said, "You know, my husband gets home we don't have time to talk until we eat, and then when we sit down at the table, then he tells me about his day and I tell him about my day." Well, apparently the little one never did have a chance to tell about his day. So they were really asking for that. And now they were expecting another child. And I said, "For whatever you do, help this child feel a responsibility for the younger one. Make him know that it's his baby as well as yours. And emphasize that fact when your baby comes, you know, and plan it as a mutual happy event. There'll be plenty of trauma connected with the next baby the way it is without, even though we do take precautions. One parent recommended that families reduce TV watching by playing family games, father included, or by playing musical instruments together. This is so great. Another one said, you can't fool children by giving them things like toys and TV. And TV isn't all bad, but so much of it is that we need to watch TV. When our children watch TV, we need to watch TV too at the same time. So that if it isn't what we thought it was going to be, and if there is something bad about it, then we can talk to them about it and help them become discriminating in what they watch. The parents often stated the old adage is that output correlates with input. You get back what you put in, and the more you put into your children, the better adults they will be. But tend to personal and marital needs. A number of parents specified that personal adjustment was an important prerequisite to effective child rearing. One noted that to relate well to children, adults must be confident with themselves. Comfortable with themselves, excuse me. Another parent said that one should not completely sacrifice oneself for the family, but rather keep part of yourself for yourself and do something you enjoy. By treating yourself well, this parent felt, you will avoid the feeling of being mistreated, exploited, or put upon when something goes wrong, like the martyr mother we were talking about earlier. And have a sense of humor, especially about one's faults. Admit your mistakes. If you admit your mistakes, they're going to admit theirs, and they're not going to have to lie. I know at nursery school, I used to purposely make mistakes once in a while and say, oh, did I goof, you know. And they said, that's okay, Mrs. Edmund, that's okay. And it was the same way when they goofed. That's okay, John. You do it right the next time. That's okay. And we can just kind of have some fun about our foibles and our misfortunes. Things don't have to be so serious. Like the old adage, don't cry over spilt milk. If somebody accidentally spills something, it's okay, we'll clean it up. You know, that's not so serious. In addition to personal adjustment, the parents stressed the importance of keeping a good, solid marriage. Love, respect, and faithfulness between spouses provided the needed security to the family. Two comments by parents seem particularly helpful. A household in which love is openly expressed is a household in which children flourish. Verbalizing love to one's children is not enough. Parents should make every effort to let their children see the warmth and the tenderness in their marital relationship. Parents should not underestimate the importance of letting their children know how delighted they are when their spouses enter the house. The morning greeting and the goodnight kiss set an atmosphere which encourages the same kind of affection in the hearts and minds of the children. A husband and wife are apt to be very successful parents when they give the totality of their marriage the first priority. It may seem that the children are getting second best from this approach, but they rarely are. A happy mother and father are most apt to have happy children, whose roles are clearly and lovingly defined. Child-centered households produce neither happy marriages nor happy children. And what about the apron strings? These remarks highlight what many parents are reluctant to admit, but what child experts are becoming increasingly aware of, that children tend to detract from rather than enhance the closeness between husband and wife. The parents pointed out the need to work at maintaining closeness with a spouse by such means as weekly nights out together, occasional weekends alone together, tender greetings, and thoughtful surprises. And they also said another important thing was to teach your children right from wrong. A number of responses highlighted the need for parents to actively teach their children basic values and manners in order for them to get along well in society. Parents found the following ways helpful in socializing their children. For instance, the assignment of chores and other responsibilities at home. Religious affiliation. Insistence that the children treat others with kindness and respect and honesty. Emphasis on table manners and other social graces in the home. Actually, manners are just a way of showing respect to those who are around us. Part-time jobs outside the home when the children are old enough, and the setting of personal examples of moral courage and integrity. We don't talk about cheating on our taxes or trying to get by without paying for something. If they are with you as you're being checked out and the checker happens to undercharge you for something, if you stop and say, I think that you have this wrong now, I think these are 50 cents instead of 45, the child will have an example of moral integrity set for him. The respondents also stressed that they thought parents should articulate their own moral values and talk about them with their children, not in a preachy way, but talk about them, letting the children add their comments. Children should be made aware of proper values, behavioral, financial, and so forth. When they stray, parents should communicate in a manner which encourages the child to listen. Do not be permissive or rigid, but firm, so the children know exactly where you stand. Teach children to respect people, to be honest, and to treat others as they themselves would like to be treated. All children have to be taught right from wrong, respect for others and their property, and respect for older people. Don't look the other way if the child comes home with a flower that obviously was plucked from somebody else's garden. Teach them the value of truthfulness. Time and again, I recall telling the children that if they told us the truth about a situation, we would do all in our power to help them. For in knowing the real facts, we could deal with any misstatements by others. If, however, they lied, we would be unable to be of much help because we couldn't depend on them. The parents emphasized the need to insist that all family members treat each other with respect. First of all, this means that parents should act in respectful ways to the children. The following behaviors exemplify this respect. Politeness, saying thank you and excuse me, and apologizing to a child when you are in the wrong. Showing an active interest in the children's activities and what they're watching on TV. Being honest and sincere with children at all times, not favoring one child in the family. Following through on promises made and showing basic trust in a child's character and judgment. In addition, parents should insist on being treated in a respectful way by their children. If parents treat each other with respect and love and teach the children this respect for the older parent, a solid foundation will be laid for this behavior by the children. And another parent suggested, parents should maintain their individuality and cultivate their own interests and talents. The time, feelings, and interests of both parents and children should be respected. The most important thing that parents in this study learn by experience is that the undeviating love must go hand in hand with discipline, that indeed one is not truly possible without the other. Moreover, in order to love and discipline most effectively, it is necessary to spend constructive time with the children. It would seem, then, that while adjusting to changing times, it is important for parents to hold fast to these and other basic unchanging principles of child rearing. Now, do any of you have things you'd like to add or comment on?
Well, I think something that really is important, I think, is the idea that what we do, the child expects that's okay, you know, like live the way you want your child to live. Like, I have friends who say that when their child bites them, they bite them back.
Oh.
And I say that just shows that kids can't bite, but adults can. Or,
right.
You know, if your child hits you, hit your child back. And it's the same thing.
Yeah, same thing. That's a good point. A very good point. Do you want to add any more?
No, just the idea.
Anybody else?
Whatever you do, the child thinks it's okay. Then he's
right.
Able to do it too.
Absolutely.
There was a study that was done by Harvard University, and it's been over 50 years ago now, because they've gotten their results back, and it was they sent students out to an area in like Brooklyn or the Bronx, and got a list of 50 children living in this area, which was not considered maybe the most promising area for children to be living as far as what their expectancies of where they would be farther down the line. And they listed them and who they were and, you know, all
yeah.
this kind of thing and where they were in school and everything. And they went back like 25 years later to see what had happened to these children and were interviewing the children where they had been, and they came across a good percentage of these children who had done very well compared to the whole group, and they kept running across one thing that came up again and again, and it was that all these ones who had exceeded, had not been in jail, had not had so many drug problems, all this kind of thing, mentioned having a particular teacher in
yes.
school. And they went to find this teacher who was now retired in a retirement home for teachers, and they went and talked to her, and they said that your name kept coming up as something that helped these children as they were going along, and can you think of something in particular that you did that would have made this difference? And they said, the teacher looked at them and she kind of shook her head. She said, no, I really can't. But she said, I really love those kids.
Sure. Right.
I was thinking something else, you know, the idea of the punishment, you know, getting away from spanking, and that if you are creative, you don't need to spank. And I was thinking, I've been in parenting classes, and one of the best ways, it sounds terrible, I found is isolating a two-year-old. I mean, if you're doing something that is not nice in a group, child hates being away.
Right.
So, whenever Gordy would bite me, put him in his room for 2 minutes. That's a long time.
Yeah, right.
And things like that, and like putting him in a 4-year-old in a corner for 2 minutes is a long time.
Isolation is accepted by most psychologists as a very good means of disciplining, because they'll have a chance to think over what they were doing and why they had to
be. The only thing is you have to be dedicated to be teaching your child, because everybody said, well, if I put my child in the corner, he's not going to stay there.
Oh.
But I say, all I have to do is stand over him for 5 minutes. I've got 5 minutes in the
of
day.
Of course.
If it's that important to me, I just stand there and make him stand there.
Of course.
5 minutes is
that's
short.
That's a good contribution. Did anybody else have any good ideas? Yes.
I got one thought, and it's being honest with your children.
Oh, yes.
I have a 14-year-old, and he's always kind of testing me. And a lot of times if Tom's gone, he'll come up and he'll say, well, I'm going down the Cedar River today with my friends. And I think, oh no, that doesn't sound right to me. But you know, I'm not always sure if he's big enough for these things. And so I want to check with Tom. And he'll make fun of me. He says, yeah, go call Dad. You have to go call Dad, don't you? And I'll say, you know, Brian, I've never raised a 14-year-old boy. I said, you know, Daddy said he used to go bike riding when he was young for 5 miles away from home. And he has some good ideas on what you're capable of, too. So I need to check with him. I'm not always sure. And then he'll kind of...
Sure. Well, he should appreciate, and I'm sure he does appreciate that.
But he wants to challenge it first.
Sure.
But, you know, it seems like as soon as I say, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Then he'll kind of...
I remember my mother, we lived in the country, and I drove the car. And in order to go to get to things, I had to drive. And it was raining, and I knew the roads were slippery, and I remember asking my mother, can I have the car to go to the game tonight? And she said, do you think it's best to drive on these roads now while it's raining? So she just put the monkey right back on my back, and I had to make the decision. Was it best for me? I knew I'd be terribly embarrassed if I landed in a ditch. And
especially
my dad,
when you made the decision.
That's right. But she didn't say, no, you can't. Then I would have probably have been angry with her, but...
Your first reaction is to do that, though. I mean, you won't be worried about him going down the river if you just don't let him do it.
That's right.
That's your
if you
reaction.
Stop, I think that's a good principle. Stop and think it over and consult with your... If it's a real decision to be made, talk to your husband about it.
I think about being a single parent at this stage, and boy, that would be hard.
Yes,
not having anybody to check.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.